advertisement for extra strength brighteners people put in their wash. Daisy did up my hair, too. She said I looked like $1 million, but she was probably exaggerating. Then I did it. I threw my arms around Aunt Sid, and after the 2-second contact, while I looked at the sidewalk glinting with sunshine, I told her I had waited for this moment ever since I was 5, when I first met her and her coral lipstick. I said I had had the feeling, so long ago, that I was destined to visit her in DeKalb. She has a laugh like water coming over a waterfall, sparkling and frothing. I wish I could hire Charles Dickens to describe Aunt Sid. I don't have a chance in the world to do her justice. She wore beige slacks and a sleeveless blouse with brown horses galloping in rows across green turf. Her hair was piled on her head, as usual, and her smile came directly from the heart. If I were a Catholic, I believed that the Blessed Virgin Mary came to look like Aunt Sid when she got older, after her son died and her life got on track. When I mentioned that very thought to Daisy, at home, she, an unbeliever, said I could get struck down for thinking such a thing. She also told me I was creating a goddess out of an ordinary person, which I admitted to myself, only for a moment, was exactly the beauty of Aunt Sid. Daisy said, "You'll probably find out one of these days that she picks her nose with a tuning fork." When Daisy made that remark, I stepped in a whole bed of marigolds and ground my heels into the earth. If Ruby and May and Dee Dee, and just about everyone I knew, could have comfort in their alcohol, I saw no reason why I couldn't have the fantasy of Aunt Sid. Someday I was bound to find out that she had a terrible quirk, but until then, there was no harm in believing she was a good witch. Aunt Sid drove me all over DeKalb. She showed me the State University. We saw a tour bus full of Chinese people jabbering at each other in their language, which surely requires gymnastic classes for the tongue and the voice. I giggled at how crazy they were speaking, while Aunt Sid pointed out all the buildings and what kind of learning took place in them. I kept looking around to see if there were any criminals, fresh from Chicago, waiting to rape the college co-eds, but no one looked like a knifer. Summer school was in session, and people were scurrying along the paths with their notebooks tucked under their arms. Finally, Aunt Sid took me to her blue wooden house. There was an arch of oak trees over her street, so the sunshine can't blast through and make the cement boil. She has a front porch, screened in, and a yard with the wildest display of flowers and colors. Crimson and indigo, vermilion and plain yellow, lush green, and an entire bed of blinding white petunias. There is a special rubber door with a slit in it so her collie dog, Elizabeth, can go in and out whenever she pleases. She looks at you with moony eyes, hoping for food. I knew I should be sad to think of Ruby back in Honey Creek with his wobbly leg, lying in the heat of the house. But my body, my mind, couldn't conjure up unhappiness for anything just then. We sat at lunch on the porch, in elegant white wire lawn furniture, sipping our lemonade politely. Aunt Sid told me about her neighborhood and the children who lived on the block, and gradually she started remembering how she used to play back at the home farm, in the hayfields and pastures, in the creek. I couldn't keep my mind on her words because I was concentrating on eating daintily until she started talking about May's Willard Jensen and the ingenious methods she had for spying on the smooching couple from the closet in the basement. I had had no idea how May felt about Willard. I had only seen pictures of him once, and May got irritated with me for asking about the people. She snatched the photos away, and I never saw them again. After we finished eating our egg salad sandwiches, cut in wedges, with green olives and lettuce, and emptying our little bowls filled with melon balls, Aunt Sid brought out her 3 photo albums, each one filled with old pictures. She sat on the arm of my chair and told me about every picture. I couldn't look at them hard enough. I couldn't stop staring at the snapshots of May when she was a girl, squinting into the sunshine with her hand over her forehead. She was young and thin, with the entire world before her, or so she thought. Aunt Sid told me how Willard Jensen and May danced in the basement and the dirty clothes went scooting around the floor. There was a picture of the two of them, with their arms around each other, smiling into the great unknown. The photos, the stories, put May in a new light. I almost said out loud that I wished May herself had wanted me to know her as a young girl with heartaches. After lunch, Aunt Sid took me up to my room. She said she often napped in the heat of the day. She disappeared around the corner to her room, which was filled with heavy golden sunlight and white curtains billowing and snapping in the open windows. When she was gone, I took off my skirt and my blouse and climbed under the cool perfumed sheets. I didn't sleep, of course, but I lay there, not daring to move, staring around myself. The room was white with paintings in gilded frames on the walls, paintings of haystacks and ponds, blue and yellow, shimmering. My room had a desk in it, and shelves with books, some of which I had read on the blind tapes. I knew the authors. I was half afraid I had taken some of Ruby's drugs. And when I came to, I would be sitting on the sofa at home, absently stirring the ice cubes in his rum and coke and staring into the gray space. I kept my eyes open so I wouldn't drift off and dream I was in Honey Creek. Later in the afternoon, we went to Aunt Sid's school, and I saw the empty room where her choir rehearses. She sat at the piano playing and singing a song by Brahms. She hissed and gurgled softly in the German language. Her lips quivered with the notes while she closed her eyes to listen to herself. If you want to see a sight to make you get lumps in your throat, watch Aunt Sid singing. It will slay you each time. When we got home, Aunt Sid cooked steaks on her small outdoor grill, and I sat on the patio drinking a gin and tonic she had made for me. In the next house, someone was playing the piano, and it seemed as if everything in the yard, the flowers, the green grass, the still evening itself, heard the music and became part of the melody. Children down the alley were playing Kick the Can, calling out and laughing. We didn't speak as Aunt Sid prepared the food, and I wasn't really too nervous while I sat waiting. After a drink, we got to talking. I answered her questions about spotting and how to remove tough stains. She wanted to know about every single person who worked at Trim and Tidy, and I told her about Artie and how he was always giving me good advice. I mentioned his prized possession, the Trim and Tidy bowling trophy. After my second drink, I had enough courage, and I said, "Aunt Sid, do you remember when you sent me money to buy May perfume for her birthday?" Aunt Sid nodded, "Yes." She had a piece of lettuce that she was trying to get into her mouth. I didn't get the perfume for May. I bought myself some brassieres. I went scarlet recalling it, but it was funny. I knew it was. Still, it was something that I'd always wanted to confess. Aunt Sid groaned in sympathy with me, and then she said that growing up was so difficult. I banged my hand on the table in agreement. She reached over and petted my arm. She murmured, "You poor thing." I shrugged it off. I wasn't in the mood for crying into a 5-gallon drum. Plus, I didn't want her to think I was a ninny. I said I was a dumb kid back then. I didn't travel places by myself. Somehow her saying I was a poor thing cast a pall over the rest of the dinner, and we quietly ate our steaks and the baked potatoes and the green beans with slivered almonds on them. For coffee, she suggested moving to the screened-in porch, and when she brought out the mugs, she also had a box containing all my letters, tied up by the year in green ribbon. She had saved my letters because they were precious to her. I sat in my chair, long past dark, reading my life over by candlelight, while Sid moved in and out, doing her chores, washing the dishes, reading her paper. Most of the details and events I had written about were exaggerated, or had never taken place. The crickets, the moon, the dark, cool air moved in through the porch screens, but I was unable to budge. I was meeting a strange and familiar person through her words. I couldn't believe I had written the letters. I was actually a little bit impressed and very horrified by my imagination. I found a letter that described my promotion to the superior English class. I hadn't admitted that I was in the lowest of the low, and that I was merely moving up one step into the regular class. I talked about how Mr. Davidson said I was improving miraculously, and that I had such a good grasp of the books we were reading. All lies. I never once mentioned the fact that after a month I was demoted. "Aunt Sid," I said to her while she sipped her coffee, "I told so many lies in my letters to you. Half of the things I described didn't even happen." She chuckled. She said that's what pen pals were for, to share fantasies with. She rubbed her eyes with her fists. She looked up, serious all of a sudden, and said, "You, all of you, should have visited me years ago. I should have demanded it." "I don't know," she said. "I wanted to help May and be friends in some way, but we have always lived such different lives. We're practically a different generation. And I had so many more opportunities than she did. Mother and father had more money by the time I came along, and Marion encouraged me to go to college, and the teachers in Stillwater urged me to pursue voice training. I grew up in a different era." She stirred her coffee, and then cupped her hands around the mug, gathering its warmth. "Maybe she just couldn't forgive me." She looked up after a minute. "I shouldn't be saying these things to you," she said. "But I want you to know that you're dear to me." I almost tipped the chair over so I could lie still in the state of grace. I wanted her to stop talking before she said something like, "If I had seen you sooner, maybe you wouldn't be retarded." I couldn't stand it when she was solemn. I petted the dog and stared at its limp tongue. Then Aunt Sid asked me a lot of questions about my life. And wouldn't you know it, I was feeling so lively, I didn't tell her every detail. I couldn't bring myself to tell her the truth for the millionth time. I said that Ruby and Justy and May and I were in the house together still, of course, and that it worked out pretty well, because May babysat, and she loved Justy even better than Rock Hudson. I mentioned that May had had some rough times over the years, when we were growing up, and she had to raise us single-handedly. Now that I was a parent, I said, trying to sound knowledgeable, I could imagine how miserable being alone with small children could make a person. I didn't elaborate on how noise and dirt and whining rile you to the point of wanting to strangle everything within reach. Aunt Sid and I agreed that May didn't have anything handed to her on a silver platter. She had had to fight for every gain, what there was of them. But with Justy here now, I told Aunt Sid it was an entirely new life for all of us. I mentioned that Matt didn't ever write or come home. He was a missing person, abducted by the world. May had to learn about Matt from Dr. Heck, the school principal. She had to pretend Matt wrote her and told her trivial things, such as what his apartment looked like, when actually she was longing to hear substance. She would ask Dr. Heck, did Matt say where he was working? Dr. Heck probably had it all figured out because he told May in his gentle voice everything she wanted to know about Matt. It's the limit, I said to Aunt Sid, not feeling a bit guilty for bad-mouthing Matt. Aunt Sid shook her head and said it was a shame. I explained that Ruby wasn't the most notorious genius on earth, not like Matt, but I knew his capacities before I married him. I said he wasn't going to solve any riddles of the universe, and he had a little trouble holding down a job, but it didn't matter a bit. He had so many good points. I told her about the times he was kind to people, buying May a toaster oven, and what a playful father he was for Justy. I bragged about his high, sweet voice, wishing she could hear him sing. Briefly, I mentioned that he drank sometimes, and that it worried us, the way he could guzzle serious quantities. I quickly added that he knew how to handle it, that he didn't trip around or bully people. I mumbled that it scared me, that I knew it wasn't healthy, and that we weren't rich enough to support a drunk or a drug addict, I said to myself. I said that Ruby's counselor, Sherry, was helping him out. He was improving little by little. I explained my life to Aunt Sid and how I spent my days, but I skipped over the bad parts. I told her about the qualities I admired in May and Ruby. There was only half a person pictured in my mind when I got done describing each one. I couldn't bring into my line of vision their heads or their chests, where their hearts should have been. Aunt Sid said it was astonishing that we all could live together and get along. She said it was remarkable, that I was a wonder. She thought it must mean so much to May to have her young people and the baby. When Aunt Sid said I was a holy wonder, I felt like what I did in my life was worthwhile, helping my family, seeing May into her old age, and having a husband with a singing voice, even though houses shrank in front of him sometimes, and it looked like a midget could live in them. But finally, as we were standing by the kitchen door, saying goodnight, I told her to her face. I said if she hadn't written the letters to me, I wouldn't be able to hold my head up walking down the street. Naturally, I didn't have the right words to tell her that she had made me strong, that if it weren't for her telling me time and time again that I was a good person, with novel ideas, I might have shriveled into a warty frog croaking in single syllables from the marsh. I always got the feeling, even when I wasn't telling the whole truth to Aunt Sid, that she took my lies with a grain of salt. When I whispered that she had saved my life, she gave me a big hug. I had to clamp my teeth together to keep from crying my entire head off and destroying her real silk shirt. Chapter 18. The strange thing when I got off the bus in Stillwater was how I didn't recognize the town. It didn't look like where I wanted to be. My clenched hands were cold and sweaty. There was nothing left of my fingernails or cuticles. I wished the bus had gone straight through Stillwater, not stopped for a single person. Even though I had the front seat, I waited to be the last one off. It was twilight, only the air was thick and the sky had turned yellow, as if it were burning up from the heat of the day. Maybe night had decided not to come. Perhaps we were going to have afternoon for the rest of our lives. Daisy was on the sidewalk, trying to make Justy wave to me. He had a sucker in his mouth, so he wasn't about to obey. He looked at me with accusing eyes for the longest time. After a while, he whispered, "Mama." When Daisy gave him to me, he buried his head in my neck. "When are you going to have a baby?" I said, first thing. "Give me 10 years, maybe 20. Daisy winked at me. She had to be joking, because in 20 years her eggs would be used up. On the way home in the car, she kept asking so cheerfully how I enjoyed my trip. I told her that yesterday we went to Aunt Sid's school and ate dinner, and today she took me downtown and we ate lunch in a cafe. I didn't feel like going into much detail. My time with Aunt Sid was a secret I had already stashed away. If I explained to Daisy, out loud, our morning on the porch eating English muffins, my memory of it would become fixed. I wanted the whole experience to remain fluid and new. There was the danger that Daisy might make a joke, as she later did about the tuning fork, and I'd have to stamp out marigolds and make excuses for my self-believing in magic. I didn't want to know, but finally I had to ask. I said, "How are Ma and Ruby?" She coughed, saying, "It was a rough 2 days for them while you was gone." "That don't surprise me a whole lot," I said, and then we rode quietly the rest of the way home. May had a pan of chicken frying on the stove. She looked like she didn't have the strength to poke the pieces. Her curls were greasy and slack, and her eyelids hung low. "I don't want to hear nothing about Sydney," she said, right when I walked in. "I don't want to know about the great time you had." "That's fine with me," I said, breezing through the kitchen. Ruby was lying on the couch with a beer between his legs in the position I left him. He acted like a real big baby when I touched him. "Ouch, you're hurting me," he whined. I hardly put any pressure on his thigh. He squinched up his face so he looked exactly like the Chinese tourist in DeKalb focusing their cameras. "You look like a Jap," I said, and then I gave him a quick peck on the cheek and told him I'd thought about him while I was gone. He turned all blubbery and said, "Oh, baby, I missed you too." I hadn't meant that I'd missed him, but I didn't correct his impression. He told me he didn't like to live without me. He meant without me serving him. Daisy went home, and then May and Ruby and Justy and I sat down for chicken dinner. "The minute her fanny hit the seat," May said, "My, what a juicy chicken this is, Ruby. How good of you to get it for us. Don't it smell delicious? Thank you for making it possible." She licked her chops and smiled at Ruby, thanking him. He didn't look at her, not once. He slurped his milk like a hound dog. I couldn't figure out what was going on with those two, so I paid attention to Justy. I told him about the oak trees and DeKalb making a bridge over the street. He had an expression on his face that said, "I love how nice you're talking to me, Mama." "Justy," I said, "I heard Aunt Sid sing. Her voice sets your whole spine shivering, and she sings a language we don't know." "He don't know a word you're saying," May chimed. "My, ain't this chicken tender?" She tore the skin off a drumstick and sank her teeth into the meat. "Aunt Sid's house is filled with light and color, Justy. Someday you can see it for yourself. I know you and me will get there to DeKalb for another visit." Ruby suctioned up his jello, face down to his plate. He made one long, noisy sucking sound. "Ruby, you was such a sweetheart to get this scrumptious meal for us. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your thoughts, especially when that leg of yours is good for nothing." May talked straight to Ruby, even though he was looking over his shoulder at the back door. "Justy," I said, "did you have fun at Aunt Deasy's this afternoon? Were you a good boy?" He nodded his head and said, "Do." "Do" was the only word he spoke clearly, except for "no." "No, no, no, no," he could say. "No" with perfect diction. "You know what?" May said, taking a huge, ferocious bite of bread. "I don't think I've tasted better chicken in my whole life. Ruby, This one tastes as good as Grandma's devil's food cake. I think they're improved when they... She leaned over the table and spit the words out. Hang from their necks. He was looking clear out the back door. She wanted to catch his eye, tack it up for a trophy. What's going on, Ma? I shouted, banging my hand on the table. How come you're talking about this chicken like it's Jesus H. Christ? She stood up with all her theatrical flair. She had been dying for me to ask. She pointed at Ruby like she was the victim finally pointing out her assailant in the lineup. Ruby can't control his emotions too great. Oh, no, he can't. She spoke in her hushed tone. She spit out her T's and her C's. Don't they have places for people who can't control themselves? Maybe we better call the funny farm. I'd say it's about time. If I didn't know there was bloods and guts inside a person, I'd say what's down in May's belly is a furnace making her words come out to sizzle people, to char them until there's nothing left but smoldering ashes. Daisy always said I went to extremes when I exaggerated, but I have to say my impressions, even if they aren't true to science. May went on to tell the story of how Ruby strangled a chicken and then hung it out on the porch by the macrame plant holder he made down at the resource center in Stillwater, where Sherry works. Of course he had to go strangle May's favorite hen, the one which lays the best. She milked that part for all it was worth. She said, "My favorite hen," about 5 times in a row. She stood ripping the skin off her second piece of chicken, and then she said, "I went to look out the window, and there was my favorite hen hanging by the neck on the porch." She wasn't having too much trouble consuming her favorite creature. Taking a bite for the road, she marched to the sink to find her cigarettes. She put one between her lips and it dangled there like a wire hanging from a busted fixture. I stared at May and at Ruby back and forth. I knew they expected me to say something. Ruby was watching the kitchen door with his mouth drooping open. All I did was pick up Justy, wipe his mustache, and take him into the living room. We played, seeing as I'm his mother. I made a fort out of chairs and blankets, and then we went inside and sat. I escaped to Justy's play world, where the blankets caving in on your head is the worst thing that can happen. When I tucked him into bed, I sang him a song I made up about a mother and son who drive away to Texas and pick fruit for the rest of their lives. I watched his eyelids get heavy, opening and closing. Every time they opened, he looked into my face. He was learning it by heart, for future reference. When I came downstairs, Ruby was watching TV. I stood in front of him and said, "How come you strangled the chicken, Ruby?" He clamped his jaw shut and stared without blinking around my form, at a show with cops chasing down alleys. "She gets me riled up," he finally whispered, avoiding my face. I sat down and waited. During the commercial, he blurted that he had only wanted to take Justy out in the car to the store, but she wouldn't let him. She said it wasn't safe to drive with that leg of his. She said it wasn't safe to drive with that brain of his, for that matter. And then she went down and threw the keys to both cars into the marsh. He closed his eyes and said, "I couldn't help it, baby. I had to wreck something." "Don't pay any attention to her," I whispered, petting his hair. "She don't know everything." I said the first thing that came into my head because I had to think about the situation. Telling him not to pay attention to May is like saying, "Pretend that wasp in your ear didn't just bite you 40 times. I was also confused because I secretly had to admit that May was probably right. It's quite possible it wasn't safe for Ruby to drive the way his vision wavers on occasion. Still, if person has got to know himself and figure out what's right without someone else saying, "Don't breathe, don't eat, wake up." Ruby said May should be the weed commissioner because she'd be a natural getting people to hack out their thistles. She'd stab people with thorns if they let their wildflowers go to seed. I went into the kitchen and said to May, "How are we going to go anywhere if you threw the keys into the marsh?" "I've got spare sets," she said, smirking at me. I had a fervent need to nip her flanks. We didn't say anything more on the subject of car keys and strangled chickens. After that episode, we settled back down to normal. I knew I had merely dreamed of going to Aunt Sid's, or maybe seen a late-night movie about an aunt and her niece lounging in chairs, eating orange marmalade and English muffins. When I think back to that fall of 1977, it seems as if our life went in slow motion. We were taking each step so carefully. It was one of those long autumns. It lasted for years. We woke up to the pale sun coming in over the blankets, and we knew it was warm outside. We were being fooled. The ground we walked on was golden and dry, all the grasses dead. Nothing anywhere seemed to have juice. Artie always came to pick me up for work, and we drove past the cemetery in Honey Creek, where all the maples turned rust-colored for 1 minute, and then the next thing the smart trees did was let go, and there were thousands of leaves to rake. Sometimes I took Justy to the cemetery after work. We shuffled through the leaves, we threw piles in the air and watched them float down to earth. I wished I could talk to trees. Seems as if they know so much. I wished I could turn a beautiful color and then let go of myself. Just let it go. When I look back on it, I realize that we were all quiet that fall. We were looking into ourselves and kindling our flames. We were tending our fires. Then, all of a sudden, in the space of Halloween morning, the sky turned cloudy, and the air changed from warm to bitter cold, so that when we went outside, our nostrils stung and tears dripped from our eyes. The harsh winds were here. We sniffed the air with the knowledge of the woodchuck there in our noses, giving us faith in a cold, dark winter. I wished I had a hole in the ground that I could crawl into without leaving any trace. Ruby didn't go to work because his leg was still giving him trouble. He was getting a tire around his middle from watching TV and drinking beer. He didn't shave. He no longer looked like a cute jungle Tom. He did some work around the house now and then. He oiled the doors so they wouldn't squeak at night and scare him, and he took care of the hens when he felt like it. They didn't spook him anymore. He went into the hen house and screamed and clapped his hands, and the hens all flew into a corner. When May wondered why egg production was down, I shrugged my shoulders. Ruby was also working on a needlepoint rug. Dee Dee bought him a kit because she knows how much he likes to use his hands and how capable he is. It was a picture of a sailboat against a deep blue background. He was loaded when he sewed the sail, so it didn't match up with the rest of the boat. Dee Dee ripped it out in her spare time. It was going to be a bath mat. Ruby sat and watched TV, making his rug. We were all hoping his leg would feel better fairly soon, before we went bankrupt. Often he played with Justy on the floor, and they turned into two rambunctious house pets. I grinned, watching my boys. They wrestled and rolled around, both of them howling, and then Ruby chased Justy up and down the stairs. Justy squealed, running on his fat legs out the kitchen door, covering his face. Thinking we couldn't see him, Ruby would growl, "Where did that midget go?" He'd bang open the door and sniff and roar, and then Justy had to shriek with the pleasure and terror of it. May disapproved of Rough House. She said Justy was going to be traumatized. She said the screams hurt her ears, not that she should be considered, but she didn't like to see Justy so upset. Ruby and Justy learned to play while she was at work. They had some good laughs. They were the men of the family, sharing the joke. It was May and I who disciplined Justy. Ruby left the room whenever Justy started to act up or require a firm hand. Ruby liked only to roll around on the floor and make Justy tremble. I still went to trim and tidy half-time. Could have fooled me. It seemed as if I was there night and day, looking at soiled garments. Artie had to bring sweaters back to me, showing me I had missed an enormous stain. He'd say, "You all right?" And I'd always say, "I'm sorry, I can't figure out what's the matter with me." I laughed a good hearty fake laugh and added, "I need a new brain or something. I can feel mine giving out." And Artie always said, "You take it easy." "Sure, Artie, I'll take it easy." I kept hearing the words, "take it easy," and tried to figure out how a person did it. I probably wasn't paying enough attention to spotting because I was dreaming about taking Justy away with me in a car. I don't even know how to drive. I couldn't help picturing Justy and me alone. I'm carrying a suitcase full of the money I stole, heading for a place where you can wear t-shirts night and day, winter and summer. I wrote Aunt Sid to tell her the morning on the porch was fuel to me. I dreamed with my eyes open about eating English muffins and telling true stories to each other. Now that Justy was going on 2 years old, getting his nose into every drawer and cabinet, walking and talking, there were a lot more decisions to make about what was best for him. Now he had thoughts of his own. He was a person, full-fledged, not only a sweet baby you wanted to kiss and admire. We squabbled about what was best for him 24 hours a day, Ruby and May and me. "He's not warm enough in that sweater. It's his nap time. Don't let him suck on his finger. Get him off that stool, he's going to kill himself." It didn't matter what it was, because we all had different ideas. May and I did not want him to have sugar. We didn't want his teeth to be rotten like Ruby's. But Ruby didn't care. He wanted to make Justy happy, and a piece of gum could do it. Justy was like a pesty cat, rubbing against your legs, always begging for something to eat. He knew Ruby carried sticks of gum in his pockets, that he was always very available. Justy would eat double bubble, chewing it with his front teeth, and then he'd swallow it. I couldn't bear to think of the gum sticking to the inside of my boy. But Ruby wouldn't listen to me, because May was always yelling at him about the sweets. Ruby thought I was on May's side. He saw it as a team sport, May and me against Ruby and Justy. To Ruby's way of thinking, May and I were the strongest team, beating up the unshaven and the young. He probably figured, in his dream state, that he was going to show us a sensational upset one of these days. Then he could sneak gum to Justy any old time. The first day it snowed in early December, the weatherman didn't spare us. We woke up to a foot of snow, doing nothing but sitting on the ground, here to stay. I asked myself three things when I saw the bitter scene out my window. How am I going to get out of here with Justy? How am I going to get away from this chill? Where can I steal some money from? We could all feel how cold it was to be. Already there were icicles poised like daggers from the roof. The winds blew across the fields, freezing the inside of your nostrils, only minutes after you stepped outside. It was dangerous to venture 2 feet from the kitchen door. I remember nothing about Christmas, except that Ruby bought Justy a sled, and May said Justy was going to kill himself on it. She hated hazardous toys. She said, Didn't Ruby know better? I had to ask myself, wait a minute, isn't that kind of regular for a father to buy his boy a sled? I was mixed up. I couldn't begin to answer the question. There were weeks when Justy couldn't go outside. He went for almost the entire month of January without feeling fresh air. Ruby wouldn't go out either, and being cooped up made both of them squirrely. They were restless. You could hear it in Justy's whine. You could see it in the furious way Ruby tossed things around the house. He stood at the window, tapping his foot, not hearing a word I said. The one time we tried going outside, as a family, was a failure. I bundled Justy up, and he ran out into the bright day so eagerly, as if he were greeting the cold, making it feel welcome. He ran straight for something brown lying in the snow. When I got to him, I saw that it was a golden dog frozen up. Its fur shimmered in the sunshine and flapped in the wind. It was frozen in a running position. Justy touched it. He didn't understand about dying yet. He wanted it to get up and play with him. He was crazy about puppies. I said, "Let's leave it, okay?" It had starved. Its eyes were wide open, staring at the tongue glued to the snow. "Get in here," May yelled from the porch. "You're all going to get frostbit. Don't touch that mangy dog, Justin," she commanded, like it was going to come to life and bite his cold fingers off and then lie back down dead. "Come on, Justy, let's skate on the marsh," is what Ruby said, and they headed for the ice. I stood in the middle, stuck, growing quieter and quieter, saying to myself, when is the big event going to happen that will get me out of here? During the winter, when we were shivering and coughing in our bed all night, Ruby treated me as his own thing, if he felt like it. I didn't want to get so close, but he said Mr. Magic Fingers could make a dried-up creek bed gush. Besides, he said, I was his wife, and there were certain things I had to do. He said that it was the law, that the police were going to catch up with me if I didn't behave right. I'd leave my body behind, and with my mind and my heart, I'd go sit on the porch at Aunt Sid's, with the warm buns and your choice of three jams. There were other times when out of the cold night I had terrible dreams. I dreamed I got caught in a tremendous mousetrap as large as a car. It didn't kill me, so I flailed around. There was no one willing to let me out. Even Aunt Sid stood up so she could see me from her porch. She watched my neck breaking and clapped as I got closer to death. I must have been crying because Ruby rolled over and started singing that old song, "Hush, Little Baby." That's how he could be. One night, toward the end of January, we were eating supper. Our bodies were covered with goose flesh, even underneath our jackets, because May was still skimping on the oil. We watched our breath coming out of our mouths. The adults sat in silence. May had the oven door open, but it didn't do any good. Justy cried hysterically, at a pitch that pierced the eardrums. May tried to get him to shut up, but she didn't have the magic touch. I didn't say anything, because all I could do was huddle in my chair, rub my shoulders, and blow on my hands. "Don't look so damn froze up," May shouted at me out of the blue. "You always look like you got 10,000 miseries. Stop looking so cold." I laughed under my breath. I laughed louder and louder. I couldn't quit. I howled until tears rolled down my cheeks. Ruby and May stared at me. They thought they might as well roll me down the basement stairs and put me in the pickle barrel, add some salt, and close the lid. I laughed all night long. Don't ask me what Ruby and May did downstairs. Perhaps they had an ice carnival. I ran to our bedroom and laughed face down on my bed, heaving and snorting, and then I cried out loud. I guess I cried myself to sleep. Ruby and I both had our ways of retreating, leaving our bodies in the house. In both our minds, we walked out the door, going separate routes. We were headed for the place where the climate never changes. It's always warm and still, and flooded with light. Chapter 19. On the first warm day in April, Daisy had us over for a barbecue. Don't imagine that we were prancing around in tube tops and hot pants. We were all wearing coats and mittens, in addition to long underwear, I'd wager. Still, we could party outside at least, listen to the robins chirping half-heartedly. We ate a pile of chicken at the picnic table and potato chips. There was no limit to our salt consumption. We gobbled chips and pickles and then washed down the food with beer. As it got dark, Daisy and her good Bill started building a bonfire. They fed the flames with twigs and branches. We gathered around it, staring into the heat, while Dee Dee and Daisy told stories about derelicts and about customers who get their hair cut. Daisy explained how you can tell where every person in Stillwater gets their hair done. Stella's gives all the girls bowl cuts, but at Hair Village, they come out looking like Olympic skaters. Daisy bet money she could stand on the street and say where each passing person got their hair cut. She was that positive. I didn't listen carefully. I held Justy close, smelled his skin, felt him leaning into me, and it seemed that all the evil stored up in me from the winter seeped into the fire and burned. I saw my sins turning into red-hot embers. My sins were all the occasions I said to myself, I have to get out of here. I'm going to steal a suitcase of cash. And other thoughts too wicked to mention. I looked across the fire to my husband, Ruby, and clearly saw his strengths again. I couldn't help loving his blue eyes staring back at me, saying I'm such a perfect mother, holding our boy. I thought for sure I'd never have another unkind idea again. I was feeling awfully pure and stupid. When Justy fell asleep, I put him inside on Daisy's bed. We all drank buckets of alcohol and got wasted. If you consume intoxicants every now and then, it cleans out your spirit, guaranteed. I ran around the yard shouting and jumping, prancing and falling to the ground, a complete stranger to myself. At about 3 in the morning, when I was standing over the toilet, sorry for every drop I had swallowed, I heard May in the kitchen talking with Dee Dee. They were both looped out of their skulls. I wasn't trying to hear, but the voices came to me anyhow. Dee Dee, May said. You ever hate yourself so much you could slit your own throat? Dee Dee cracked up. She thought May was telling jokes. Millions of times, every day, she answered. She got up to do a little dance of death. I could hear her wide feet smacking the floor. Serious, though, May said. Sometimes I pray to God to let me be born again. Give me another chance to do good. Sometimes I think he's given me the chance, and I've changed. And other times, I just ain't sure. I pray that he won't take me before I've healed something. She started to cry. I swear. She sputtered. I've screwed up so much around me. I figured Justy is my last stab at making a child turn out halfway decent. Dee Dee was still twirling slowly. She said in a sleepy voice, What about that smart-ass son of yours? Time Magazine. Ain't that famous enough for you? May didn't like to bring up Matt, even when she was loaded. The mere sound of his name hurt her feelings. She didn't talk anymore. She slurped her joy juice out of a bottle. I wasn't sure I dreamed it or not, if the conversation was a hallucination from throwing up everything inside me. But I couldn't forget the picture of May hating herself. I imagined her sticking her tongue out at herself in a mirror, and the mirror responding. I had a week off in July, and Ruby and I spent the 7 days out on the beach in Stillwater. We took Justy and played in the sand, ate hot dogs and cokes, stretched out on towels, ran in for swims. We rented an orange boat and rolled out to the middle of the lake. We hooked buckets of fish, but there were mostly bluegills flapping around. I told Ruby to throw them back. I felt so sorry for caught fish. I couldn't help thinking we were such different people compared to all those years ago when I saw Ruby out on this same lake. I couldn't remember how we had traveled so far to be together, like we were with a little boy named Justy. We were crazy about being out in the lake. We imagined that there wasn't any such thing as land to keep us tied down. Ruby had his radio going, and the sun beat down on us with every inch of its fierceness. I lay back and slept in the flames. I wanted that ball of fire to lick me up, blue bikini and all. Ruby sang along to the radio. Justy watched the water, holding on to his baby fishing pole Ruby bought him at Coast to Coast. He was a patient little fisherman, considering he never got a single bite. All we could hear was the water knocking the boat and the rock songs. All we felt was the heat piercing down through our skin, roasting away our thoughts until we lay there empty. When it got dark, we roamed around town. We couldn't imagine ever being cold again. We were almost feverish with our sunburns. We sat in the park by the river, and Ruby sang slow songs to put Justy to sleep. He sang in his moony voice, "Oh, Mandy, you came and you gave without taking, and I need you today, oh, Mandy." We got some ice cream cones and ate them one lick per minute. Sometimes we went over to Daisy's and lay around in her yard, swatting at bugs. If the happily married couple was in bed, we sat in the yard anyhow, not talking, watching the unlit house like we thought it might possibly burst into flames for our entertainment. We pretended we didn't have an address, that we were gypsies, and we spent our lives going from lake to lake catching fish, cooking them over a fire, and eating them with our own greasy hands. Even though we didn't say a word on the subject, both Ruby and I knew we weren't going to go home if we could help it. But there'd come a time when finally there wasn't anything else to do. We'd have to drag into the kitchen, Ruby carrying Justy in his arms. May would be at the kitchen table shelling peas, not looking up at us. The kettle was always on the stove for blanching vegetables. The steam floated to the ceiling, right to where the plaster fell out about 2 years before, when May was canning pears. All the steam must loosen the ceiling bit by bit until it can't help letting go and caving in. The room was filled with the smell of steam and dust and thousands of partially cooked peas. I wish they were jade beads, because then we'd be rich and could move to Florida condominiums. Ruby always walked fast through the kitchen. You couldn't see a body. It was a streak. I had never seen a person move so quickly. He must have forgotten that his leg hurt him. Of course, May had to follow him into the living room so she could inspect Justin. She'd see his sunburn, the sight of which instantly transformed her from pecanner to best actress in a melodramatic role. She stood and gave us her oration on how you can get skin cancer from the sun. "Why do you do it?" she beseeched. "Why do you let him get exposed?" She stroked her front repeatedly, saying, "In a few years' time, moles will appear, and they'll get scabby, and pretty soon, With that disease, your whole body is covered with brownish, scabby sores. She itched her face. Pretty well eat you up. She carried on as if Justy had 3 weeks to live. I was tired from the heat and hot dogs. All I could say was, "Please, Ma, we're going to bed now. Don't say anything more now, okay?" But she had to discuss her age and her poor, stiff fingers. And here she was doing all the canning while her daughter got herself fried. Her apron was soaked down the front, with pee holes stuck here and there like dewdrops gone moldy. "It's my vacation, Ma." I tried to sound firm like Daisy, but I knew I was whining. May put her red, sore hands to her face. They were wet also, and crooked. There wasn't anything in medicine that could ever straighten them out. Perhaps each time I looked at those hands, I was having a little vision like Ruby has when he's drunk. Perhaps in real life her hands were lily white and smooth, the way girls' bodies are in fairy tales. Her hands didn't do anything but make me feel wretched for the race of man, plus May on top of it. Sometimes it seemed as if they were wrecked up for that purpose. So I stayed with her, shelling peas until 2 in the morning, listening to the sounds of jars clicking and water boiling, smelling peas, platters of peas, both raw and blanched. It's not an odor I like to call up. May and I didn't speak for hours. We concentrated on getting the job done while we listened to all-night radio call-in programs where people chew each other out for their strange opinions. After my vacation, I hated to go back to work. At Trim and Tidy, I was in a prison where they don't ever let a person see the sunshine, and with the chemicals stealing down into my body, contaminating the red blood cells, I felt as if I were being slowly murdered in secret. There were a few ideas I kept hashing over that summer, looking at the stained clothes, trying to keep my brain from going on the blink. I was hardly paying attention to spotting. I often thought about the words from the Rev's own mouth. It had been back in the spring, after we all thawed out, that we started going to services regularly again, because May said it was important for Justy to go to church. It seemed to me that May was growing more and more concerned about religion as the months went by. I had never realized before that she had a religious streak. Perhaps her age made her think a little. Perhaps she couldn't help being slightly anxious about where she was going to end up when she passed. She probably hoped she might have a stab at heaven. She had the idea that the Congregationalists could give her a chance, and if she did good deeds, such as go to church every Sunday, even in the summer, and make confections at Christmas time for the church needy basket, her chances would double. There were things the Rev said that made me feel better on occasion also. When I went to the service, I couldn't help it. I came out feeling holy, as if something had rinsed over me, made me clean again. Even if I didn't pay attention, I glistened, putting in my time. Sometimes I had to think over the Rev's words, because he looked me right in the eye and spoke. Around Easter, he kept shouting out, daring me to meet his gaze, "Yours is the body of Christ." He lowered his voice and said, "We will actually feel the nails coming into our flesh as we approach Good Friday." I never felt anything like that. I didn't feel nails. I wanted to say, "Hey, Rev, I don't have nails. Give me a break." I couldn't feel sorry for Jesus and his poor bloody hands because he lived 1 trillion years ago. He always made commands like, "Honor thy mother." He sure could dish out advice easily. His mother was a saint. It wasn't until I was at Trim and Tidy, trying to get grape juice out of a white linen skirt, that it came to me what the Rev meant when he talked about feeling the nails in our hands. He was actually trying to say, despite all the talk of God and Jesus, that there's no one looking after us, that we are alone, and each of us is singular. And still, all of us are miraculously the same in our aloneness, with our red blood cells streaming through our veins. May can list all the diseases that destroy the blood cells, but she wouldn't go on to say that even Polish people and her colored egg customers and the Japs are subject to disease. The only blessed way there is, I realized, is for all of us to feel deeply with a wounded or sick or even dead person. What the Rev meant to say, if he could ever have spoken plainly without all the paraphernalia of the gospel, was, each man's struggle is mine. If I were a minister, I'd shout from the pulpit, you puddle of humans down there, we are all in the same mess. I suppose I'd throw in a meek, rejoice. I'd say, here's my theory. Isn't it nice even if I can't always behave like I believe it? The Rev was always trying to get us to be compassionate by telling us about the life of Jesus. I know if the Rev scrapped Jesus altogether, I'd get the same point. How you have to feel with all your might for other people. How you have to go outside of yourself and take part in the world's community. Even though Christians kill each other, I finally understood that compassion was the main idea. I knew that salvation was only a carrot, and that in the end, there was no such thing. Still, there were the times when I loved hearing the words from the Bible. For instance, the phrase about light. For ye were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. I thought to myself, I'm going to walk as a child of light, as if I don't have bones and night doesn't ever come. The words always soothed me, even if I knew there was no truth to them. And even though I didn't believe in the Jesus stories, I like to entertain the notion that a large bearded man up in the sky pointed at objects and then poof, they disappeared. Or where there was nothing, he put a plant with fully ripe red berries growing in clusters. When May and Ruby and Justy and I went to church, people smiled at us, and it made me feel like we belonged to something good together. May was on the committee that arranged for refreshments after church, and I signed up for the Human Concerns Committee. Their mission was to find stoves and pots and pans for poor people, and when women got divorced, say if their husbands were beating them, the committee helped them through the hard time and made sure they had a place to live. I didn't do much to serve. Once I brought some canned tomatoes. May and I did up for a person who didn't have any food. It must have been the church routines, the songs, the committees, the people smiling at us, that kept us rooted to the ground. Justy kept us anchored, too, since he needed us all the time. Still, it was lucky our heads didn't float away. Mine was so full of thoughts, trying to be a child of light, and Ruby's and May's were not exactly at sea level with the pills they consumed. Our kitchen counter could have been mistaken for a pharmacy. May gobbled pills to help her sleep, pills for her arthritis, pills for her headaches, and Ruby took medicine to stop his leg hurting and aspirin for his sinuses. He could think of thousands of defects in his body that could be comforted by medication. If a person wanted to die, all you'd have to do is walk into our kitchen, swallow one capsule from each bottle, and bingo, you'd be dead. There were nights when I dreamed that I was just about to take advantage of that opportunity. I always hate the month of August. Stars shoot through the sky down to the horizon, dead, and weeds demand every inch of the garden. Even if you try to wipe out the quack grass, the velvet leaf, the pigweed, they go berserk anyway and take over. There isn't one thing you can do to stop the growth, It's their last chance for life. I always have bad dreams in August. The youngsters from town are prowling in empty barns, making love and stealing. There are thunderstorms, lightning cracking right outside the window, and Justy's crying. He's so scared. I used to get up in the night and walk through the house, closing all the windows so the water wouldn't come in and wreck the carpet. And then I'd go out on the front porch to watch the rain pelting the green grasses. There were times when I didn't care about the fierceness of the storms. I stood in my bare feet and my nightgown, feeling the rain and the wind lashing me, feeling how death comes to every single thing. Then September came and nature dried out as usual. The tomato vines lost the juice in them, and all you could see in the garden was the red rotten tomatoes sitting there like electronic eyes. That was last fall, about 3 million years ago, to be exact. Except sometimes I wake up and I think I'm right back there in September. I imagine we're all asleep upstairs, and there's one cricket in the floorboard, trying to keep the song going. Last fall it was cold and still through October. It rained at night, and the world shone by morning. The colors lasted forever. The trees didn't want to let go, but the leaves weren't brilliant like sometimes. They hung dank and dull until a final wind took them. We all sensed the dangerous weather coming on. Another winter caged inside, the car not starting. We could hear May bawling me out for acting cold.